With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Focused on the facts. Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, good to have your company. A big hour coming up. I will get to Andrew Reid, the Bondi Rescue television star and the fellow who was at the Bondi Junction Westfield complex on Saturday, and lent a hand, like so many brave, ordinary shoppers, ordinary Australians did, to close people into shops and put down curtains and to use garments from other retail stores to stem the flow of blood coming from victims' arms and throats, etc. Like, these are extraordinary actions. You know, a lot of people could have just fled, but there were some, and a lot of them, who stayed to try and help and lend a hand. And that's one of the most significant consolations that came out of this massacre that occurred at Bondi Junction on Saturday. Couple of quick little bits and pieces. I was looking at a CSIRO announcement today, press release, as you do, only because I think CSIRO have dropped the ball when it comes to energy terribly. Any kind of scrutiny of what the future holds for nuclear, for instance, has been dropped badly. They have not done their proper due diligence. They have not compared proper prices or spoken to people in the sector to be able to do any kind of scrutiny for the government, which is probably one of the reasons why the government's got no idea, because they've been given a bum steer from the CSIRO. Anyway, the CSIRO had this very mundane press release dated the 15th, news release they call it, appointing their new deputy chief executive. And I was just reading about Kirsten Rose, Ms. Kirsten Rose, who had become the newly appointed deputy chief executive. They'd never had a deputy chief executive before. And I decided, hang on a minute, let me read on. Why would the CSIRO all of a sudden create a new major senior position that probably carries $500,000 and all the great super they get for a deputy chief executive? I've heard of chief executives and I've heard of COOs and CFOs, but a deputy chief executive. I wonder why. And I was reading down, and Miss Rose will help lead the strategic direction, blah, 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 corporate speak. She will focus on how CSIRO engages and collaborates, blah, blah, blah. On announcing the appointment, the chief executive, Doug Hilton, said Miss Rose has an impressive track record, blah, blah, blah. And then you start to realise what the deputy chief executive role will entail when you get to the second last paragraph of the news release. A recognised leader in innovation, technology and gender diversity issues. Miss Rose is an Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering Fellow, an active member of the Chief Executive Women, an AmCham Governor in WA, and serves in a range of other advisory and non-executive director roles. Gender diversity. Finally, they've got their gender diversity chief executive running the CSIRO. So not only do they do the bidding of the government at every turn, they're also getting into DEI, as most of the major semi-government and government corporations and agencies do right around the world, because that is their next step, to make sure that everyone is diverse, to make sure that the best person does not get the job, because that's not what we do anymore. We don't have a CSIRO with the best and the brightest. We have the CSIRO with the most diverse, equity and inclusive staff population. And now they've got a deputy chief executive who's in charge of that with a great record of diversity. So there you have it. That's what the CSIRO has done today. I just wanted to mention that because I thought it was well worth pointing out that the CSIRO has found themselves a new position. After 60 years, a Western Sydney manufacturing business is being forced to close its doors. Have a listen to this. Because young people won't take jobs that require them to get their hands dirty. Does that surprise you? Paul Bucciarelli's Reevesby business, Stripco Sandblasting and Powder Coating, has been in the family for 60 years, but he can't find any young people to employ anywhere. hang on, didn't I see an unemployment figure of 364,000 Australians who couldn't find work? And so all of us who are working have to give money to them because we're feeling sorry for the fact that they can't find a job, and this bloke can't find an employee. Mr. Bucarelli said he had been hunting for entry-level workers for months without success and found members of the younger generations lazy and demanding. It's okay to get a job that you have to get your hands dirty. It's okay. Nobody in this country is going to feel that you are a loser, he says. You'll have a future because the country needs you. We need manufacturing. We need construction, he says. Most of Mr. Bucarelli's 9 staff at Stripco are in their 50s and 60s. So they've spent an entire career, an entire lifetime working for the same company and the same family. So no doubt they look after their employees immensely. Stripco hasn't had an employee under the age of 25 in the last 14 years, despite trying to obtain those employees. Mr. Bucarelli said people who roll up their sleeves, get their hands dirty and break a sweat had disappeared. So there is a reflection of the Australian workforce. Make sure that everyone in the world understands the Australian work ethic. As long as you don't have to break a sweat, get your hands dirty or roll up your sleeves, you're perfect as an Australian employee. They're basically gone, he says, and he would know. They've just left the industry, gotten old, retired, and the young people that are coming in have been brainwashed into thinking that these types of jobs are not part of the future. And he's decided to close his business. Wow. If only that generation would read that story and understand that their parents had their parents before them did it a lot tougher, and they should be very, very fortunate and lucky for the entitled lives that they have. Maybe it's just time to start working for it. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
There's a lot going on, so it's important to stay informed and up to date.
Get ready, because here we go.
At the top, 30 minutes past and when it breaks.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
If you watch regularly to this particular program, you would know that I've long opposed this juvenile ban that we have in this country on nuclear power. And it was only enforced in the 80s because there was a horse trading deal with the Greens over coal-fired power stations. Long story, but it was just a convenient way to shut their mouths because they can be rather whingers. While other nations are moving ahead with nuclear power options such as advanced small nuclear reactors, well, Australia, as you know, is foolishly, juvenilely attempting to power itself on the vagaries of the weather. Erratic gusts of wind and sunshine when it's not overcast. So basically, we're trying to put all our eggs into the renewable basket, which no other country has been successfully doing. By contrast, nuclear power is dependable 24/7, and there are several nuclear options to consider. And for those who think that we need to get rid of CO2, well, there's none of that to contend with either. So why aren't the Greens pushing it? My next guest will discuss one of those options, floating nuclear power plants. Dr. Stuart Ballantyne is chairman of Sea Transport Proprietary Limited. Besides being a columnist for The Spectator, he's a fellow of the Royal Institution of Naval Architects. He's got a long list of awards, including the ICHCA Annual Award 1996, Sea Trade Award 1997 from London, Cruise and Ferry Award 2003 from London, AusMEPA Marine Environment Award 2006 in Sydney, and the Institute of Export Export Hero of the Year 2008. He was awarded an honorary doctorate in science from Strathclyde University in 2014 for his services to the maritime industry. He joins me live from the Gold Coast in Queensland. Stuart Ballantyne, welcome to TNT.
Chris, good afternoon.
Good to have you on the program. We are talking something that Australia should be looking at, nuclear energy. Now, Russia established, as I understand it, the first floating nuclear power plant, which started operation in 2019. Why did Russia go ahead with this nuclear technology, and explain the technology for us?
Well, Chris, the nuclear floating solutions actually started in the 50s. 1950s.
Right.
And it was Dwight D. Eisenhower, the US president, started a project, it was Atoms for Peace. And he funded two vessels. One was a submarine, the Nautilus, the first nuclear submarine. which actually could go under the ice caps. The other one was a passenger cargo ship called the Savannah, and which was a really flash 200-meter ship carrying 95 passengers, cargo, and all sorts of things. And I managed to sneak on board that vessel as a young deck officer from an old British ship in 1967. It was in the Savannah was in the opposite berth in Manila. And I bluffed my way on board and had a look at this. It was like being on the bridge of the Star Trek,
you know,
the Starship Enterprise. And it was only after 10 minutes they realized I was an imposter. And said, like, okay, they said, what are you doing here? I said, so I mistook my ship for your ship. But at the time, you know, my old British ship was an old British passenger cargo ship, could cross the Atlantic and back again. And that was the fuel range was it. But this monstrous ship at the time could go around the world 14 times at 20 knots. On 22 kilograms of uranium, a suitcase full of uranium.
Wow.
Now, this wasn't lost on me, and, you know, an innocent 20-year-old. I thought, this is just fabulous. It's taken operational capability. Now, what's happened since then, there are now 162 nuclear-powered vessels around the world on top of the water and underneath the water, icebreakers and all sorts of things. And a lot of them actually power ashore. For instance, in San Diego, they have the American nuclear vessels are based in San Diego, and they actually power into the shore power. The Ronald Reagan, when it was in Brisbane, it actually did an exercise where they powered the shore. The Russians built this Admiral Lomonosov in 2019, went to a place called Vilyuchinsk in Far East Russia. It's not all that Far East because it's actually, if you head north from Canberra, due north for 5,500 miles, you actually arrive in Vilyuchinsk. And the must-do breakfast is toast and caviar. So when you get there. But, I mean, the Russians were ahead at the times, just after the Second World War, of course, when the Americans built this passenger cargo ship, the Russians did the same, the Japanese did the same, and the Germans did the same. And the only one that's still operating is the Russian one. She's used as an icebreaker and taking goods to remote parts of Arctic Russia.
So if we were projecting into the future, say we project 10 years from now, I can see that all the naysayers on small modular nuclear reactors, because they don't want to be situated near one, may have nothing to complain about if one is powering their communities from the ocean.
That's correct. Well, if you take the fact that 92% of us Australians like to live near the coast, so all the power stations are actually around the coast.
Yeah.
So my recent article in Spectator said, well, if that's where all the power stations are, surely we should be looking at floating nuclear power plants and that we can plug in into the cities.
You do that physically, literally?
Just build a ship and put a nuclear plant on it, bring it into the port, and there's plenty of industrial areas of all ports, and just plug it into the city. That's what the Russians have done.
Yeah.
What's happening is interesting, Chris, because Indonesia has a number of floating power plants which are gas and diesel propelled. They are now looking at replacing them with nuclear, six of them. Singapore is looking at doing the same. Russia is also doing some of these in Africa. We are the only stupid people on the block, right? We just can't get it around our heads. And you ask most people, why are we not doing this? Oh, it's bad for, you know, we could end up fried. It's just nonsense. The nuclear systems are so safe. There is no risk. There is zero risk.
I've got to go to a break and I've got to come back. Let's talk about the zero risk. And let's also talk about why we're such national numbskulls when it comes to nuclear power at the moment, except for one side of the political spectrum. We'll talk about that coming back with Stuart Ballantyne right after this break on TNT.
TNT's Jason Burmis.
Peace through strength. Now, on its surface, It sounds very good, right? Well, we're going to have a strong military and a strong defense, and that is going to bring us peace. But when you just scratch the surface a little itty bitty bit, what do they say? They say things like, we've got to give Ukraine the weapons they need to do the job. That would be impossible because there are no amount of weapon systems we can give Ukraine to end the conflict in Russia. Period. Full stop. I'm in a place called reality. So that is not an answer. That is an establishment moment that lets me know they're riding the flow of whatever will keep them in office, keep them on television, and keep them empowered.
Jason Burmis on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Oh, yes, yes.
Then I'll begin.
Even when you're just sitting around, we're rocking the talk.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, I've got Dr. Stuart Ballantyne with me at the moment, Chairman of Sea Transport Proprietary Limited. Let me ask you about safety, Stuart. What can I say? What safety features and what technology changes can we argue will negate many of the concerns ordinary people have about nuclear accidents?
Well, previously what people were scared of was rogues trying to steal the uranium and use them for weapons grade, which required high yield, high energy uranium, which is not used for what we're talking about here, ship propulsion.
It's a different grade, isn't it?
Propulsion. So we can't make nuclear warheads out of this uranium. But the latest system, the MMRs, which is the micromodular reactors, which are between 5 megawatts and 13 megawatts, and 1 megawatt will actually power 600 houses, just to keep it in context. Mm-hmm. So 5 megawatts is 3,000 houses. So the MMRs power from 5 to 13. There is no water cooling needed. Before, you know, when they talk about Fukushima, all the water contamination, and there really wasn't any water contamination, even with the Kursk, the Russian submarine Kursk, blowing up in the Barents Sea. They couldn't find any trace of this within a month. So it's the fearmongers always like to sort of sensationalize this, but absolutely, really it is such safe and compact technology these days that there is no problem. One of the things that we're trying to do, Chris, is people that require, I'll give an example, Fiji, one of our neighbors, Fiji, the biggest problem that Fiji has is importing $1 billion worth of diesel a year. That's their highest bill because they've got to import it and distribute it, roll around the island. You speak to the Fijian Prime Minister, Rambuka, say, what's your biggest issue? He said, importing diesel. Okay, would you be interested in using an MMR on a couple of local ships that every night plugs into the side of the city? Yes, of course. And I think what's happening around the world is that lots of people are embracing this, as I say, Indonesia, Singapore, people are embracing it. We are the last of the people still with their heads stuck in the sand.
Yeah.
And
see, I don't understand. Let me look at it this way. I can understand why Anthony Albanese, who led all the anti-uranium marches in his university days, would not change his mind. And I've had personal conversations off air with the Prime Minister before he was Prime Minister about his DNA when it comes to nuclear energy. So he'll never go down that track, which is why they are obstinate on this subject. But why wouldn't you, as a responsible government, Stuart, have at least a task force keeping across the vital discoveries and information that's emerging from new technology related to small modular nuclear reactors?
It's insane that they're not even discussing it. And we've now got, I think there are still 9 bans around the country, 9 different bans on nuclear, against mining, against transitioning. But the fact is, Chris, is that 70% of the world's surface, which is the water, 162 nuclear ships are presently going around it, on top of it and below it. So I can bring a ship into Western Australia. I can bring a nuclear ship into Brisbane. The only one requisite was you couldn't berth it near a densely populated area. So in other words, you couldn't bring it into, say, but Circular Quay in Sydney. Mm. But you could berth it maybe in Botany Bay in one of the tanker berths out there.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the only requisite. But they're allowed everywhere. There are people at the moment experimenting with nuclear reactors, small and micro modular reactors in Brisbane, but they can't arm it. They have to take it to another country to arm it. Amazing.
It's just, you know, it's just madness. However, there is a light at the end of the political tunnel. Peter Dutton sounds like he is seriously taking this to the next election.
Well, it's us Queenslanders are going to have to drag the rest of the country into it.
Again.
Once again. That's right. No, I think it's, and I do believe that it'll actually, one of the ways that it will come in is floating nuclear power plants.
What about cost? You know, Chris Bowen talks about cost. I don't understand how he knows so much about this when he's only taking the word of the CSIRO, who compared apples with oranges.
Well, about cost, it depends. For instance, if I buy a nuclear submarine from China or Russia, I can buy 5 of those for the cost of an American one or a UK one. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. If you're prepared to buy something that is practical but is not top of the range but does the job that you need it to do, you can get something that's affordable and pays its way.
That's exactly right.
All right. Nuclear energy has already been in use for 70 years in naval ships, commercial ships and icebreakers. We've spoken about this. Surely that is the kind of experience we could harness in this country to make ourselves a nuclear manufacturing industry, Stuart, or am I getting too carried away?
Well, I think you're being, you're one of the 80% of the people in the country with vision, but unfortunately the 20% that have no vision, they're sitting in Canberra at the moment.
Yeah.
So, but really, for instance, if I had my magic wish, I would say, well, take a floating nuclear power plant into Daru, which is 7 nautical miles from the Australian border. And you could just send across your power, your extension cord, you know, plug in the country, and I would charge you heaps for it. But it will come through floating nuclear power plants, absolutely, for sure.
That's interesting. The International Atomic Energy Agency International Symposium on Floating Nuclear Power Plants, it took place in November last year. I didn't know there was such a conference. Yes. It must be such a big event, but it's an indication that the world wants to pursue this technology, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Well, the only part that concerns me about that is, of course, they're now thinking about the regulatory framework, and it's a bit like United Nations. As soon as they put a regulatory framework, there's always fees and rules and regulations.
Yeah.
And when you say, well, why is it that let's just get it moving? And the people of Ilyuchinsk in Far East Russia, they didn't care where the power came from as long as the power came. And if you wanted your toast with caviar, you had to have reliable power. And so it was pretty simple.
Yeah,
and they're enjoying it. And Finland has just put their latest nuclear power plant. They are now the cheapest energy in the whole of Europe.
I saw that on Friday. Yeah.
Yes. So, and we've been. I recommend to all of your viewers to join the ANA, the Australian Nuclear Association. It costs you $20 a year or something. They put out a quarterly news sheet that tells you where all the other countries that are plugging and playing with nuclear And you think, why are we not doing this? This is ridiculous. You know, African, small African countries doing it in the middle of the Middle East, all around the place. And we are the only one member of the G20 that is not embracing this.
Yeah, it says a lot about our backward, I guess, approach to things that we don't understand. Anyway, Dr. Ballantyne, fantastic to have you on board. We will talk again on this subject and other nuclear kinds of subjects, because I have a feeling as we get closer to this next election in the first part of next year, it will be an agenda item.
Absolutely. Come to the first christening, Chris, when we launch the first floating nuclear power plant.
Love to. I hope it eventuates and I'm still alive. Stuart Ballantyne, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Chris.
Chairman of Sea Transport Proprietary Limited. There you go. It is ultimately frustrating to talk in those terms because there is so much potential. And if it turns out that it's not going to fit, not going to work, not going to happen, well, let's just find out. It's not going to hurt us. Why in Australia do we need to run under a desk somewhere in the fetal position and hide from things that we may not understand? It is juvenile. It is amateur. It is 30 years hence. Like, seriously, let's take a break. I've got to get a news break for you. Catching up with Andrew Reid, getting back on what happened at Bondi Junction on Saturday too, right after the news break on TNT.
Okay, everybody, listen up.
Big news.
Big news.
Now, TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The White House has stated that the United States will not participate in any counterstrike should Israel decide to retaliate following an attack on its territory by Iran. Quebec has experienced significant flooding due to heavy rainfall this week, particularly affecting rivers north of Montreal and in Quebec City. In Saint-Jérôme, located approximately 50 kilometers northwest of Montreal, officials reported major flooding on the Rivière du Nord.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Getting back to what occurred on Saturday at Bondi Junction, the final victim of the stabbing massacre was on the phone to her fiancé just minutes before she was stabbed while shopping. Chinese national Yi Xuan Cheng, 27, was killed along with five others by crazed Queensland man Joel Couchy during a horrific stabbing rampage on Saturday. According to Chinese media, Ms. Cheng was studying for a master's degree in economics at the University of Sydney. It is just too sad and needless to comprehend, isn't it? But as I said, there are some good things to come out of this tragedy, and that is the courage and bravery of many shoppers who did all they could to save victims and, of course, protect others. One of them was high-profile Bondi lifesaver and star of Bondi Rescue, Andrew Reid. He joins us now. Reidy, welcome to TNT. Thank you very much for your time.
Hello, Smithy. How are you, mate?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And it's been a terrible time for you because we're all desperately wanting to hear about who did what and who helped who and all that sort of stuff. So I do apologise for taking your time, but I won't take much of your time. When was the first, where were you when you first realised that there was something wrong in Westfield?
Mate, I was just buying trying to buy a bed in Myer, and it all kind of just unfolded from there. We were just in there and we were told that someone was outside stabbing people and we needed to evacuate.
So you could have evacuated, you could have got out like many people did, but you didn't do that, did you?
Well, we tried to like walk straight out the front, but the shutters had come down on us. So we were sort of, as we got closer to the shutters and realized they were shut, I looked through the holes, and just as we looked through the holes, we heard the shots fire, the two or three shots fired. I thought it was two, but I think I've heard other people say three, but I only heard two, and just heard bang, bang, and that was sort of around the corner. And then as I panned back, I looked down towards level four, and yeah, sadly, I could see a lady down there bleeding pretty badly, and I couldn't get out on level five, so I went down to level four, and there was a guy down there, and I said, mate, do you reckon you could open the shutter for me so I could go and help that lady? And yeah, and went down and come around the escalator, and sadly, it wasn't just her. There was more victims spread out through the shopping centre.
You know, in many ways, look, I've been, as a reporter, to many shooting scenes and I've been to stabbing scenes, and many of the paramedics and emergency staff at hospitals say that the stabbing scenes are often more horrendous because the damage you can do with a knife is can damage a multiplicity of organs as opposed to one single bullet. So you would have seen a lot of blood and a lot of damage, wouldn't you?
Mate, there was a lot of damage. I'm going to try and keep, I've sort of probably, with the adrenaline pumping in a couple of interviews that I've already done, I've probably got a bit excited and you know, probably said too much. I'm conscious of kids listening in and stuff like that. But yeah, mate, there were some really bad injuries and, you know, some of them unfortunately fatal for some of the patients that we came across. Yeah, I'm hoping the first lady that we helped was the original lady that I saw. I'm hoping that we did enough to help her. From what I hear, I think she's okay, but I'm not 100% sure. I think until I speak to her, I'll have confirmation.
So physically, what did you do? You tried to get what? Use clothing to try and compress wounds. What did you physically do?
Yeah, we didn't have, well, there was no paramedics there just yet, but there was already, on the first lady that I helped, there was already a couple of bystanders helping with her.
Right.
They were probably, that some of them were using jeans, and I thought we should probably try and get some cotton shirts and stuff to help clot the bleeding. So I just grabbed a couple of T-shirts, some cotton on, and then a fireman's bag turned up with a medical kit in it. So we used some gauze and stuff after that. But, yeah, we sort of got that lady sort of stable, and then I saw a couple of police officers working on another lady. And I knew that they need, because at this time we thought there was still that second attacker. So
right.
I wanted the police off that lady and out looking for the second attacker to keep us safe. And so I jumped on the next patient and she I checked for a pulse and I couldn't find a pulse. So I started doing compressions. And then a couple of ambulance officers arrived and we tried to put a defibrillator on her and stuff, but she was in a really bad way. We did the best we could.
So it's interesting you just raised something that you wouldn't have contended with before. You're used to saving people. You're used to coming to people's aid. You're used to applying resuscitation techniques. That's all well and good. But you've never had to sit on a beach giving someone resuscitation and look over your shoulder hoping that you won't be stabbed.
Yeah. I mean, on the first lady, I was definitely thinking about that because we'd sort of stabilised her and sort of once we sort of got to a point where there wasn't much else we could do, then it was sort of, your mind got a chance to start thinking and wondering. But then when I went over to the next lady, there was so much to do because, yeah, she didn't have a pulse and there was lots to think about. So, yeah, I stopped thinking about whether there was someone else around after that and just focused on trying to get her back. But unfortunately, I'm pretty sure, I don't think she survived. I ended up getting out of there not long after. Once all the paramedics and stuff arrived, I let the professionals do their job and got out of their way.
Did you sleep on Saturday night?
Oh, mate, a couple of hours. It was, you know, there was, we saw a lot of things that day that I probably never want to see again, but I would if I had to be honest. Like, you know, if I had to, yeah, it's never pretty, but unfortunately these things happen in the world and, you know, you know, I've spent a lot of my lifeguarding on the beach and you get put in a lot of positions where you've got to help people. And, you know, it feels nice to be able to help people. It feels, you know, and use your skill set to help people. It's like doctors, you know, they're incredibly intelligent. What they can do, and surgeons, you know, the way, you know, surgeons can operate on babies in wombs. Like, that stuff just blows my mind, you know. It's definitely not in my skill set, but, you know, paddling boards and spotting people in trouble, that's where I sort of come into my own, like the other lifeguards down there at the beach. And if we can do that to keep people safe, it's awesome. And then we can use our first aid skills that we use down there to help people in a situation in the shopping centre, well, then we'll do that too.
Yeah. Well done for what you've done to help people. You look after yourself as well, mate. Thank you very much for your time and all the best.
No worries, Smithy. Thanks for the chat, mate.
No problem. Good on you. Fantastic. Andrew Reid, otherwise known as Reedy. You would have known him from Bondi Rescue and there he was, just happened to be in the shop. They were very lucky to have the people like Andrew and many others to try and compress wounds, hold babies, you name it. Everything helped to keep people alive. And there were some, of course, as we know, and as Andrew described then, that they couldn't keep alive. And that is just the outcome of being stabbed with a knife. You know, stabbings can be even more gruesome and more destructive than a bullet to the body. And that's certainly the way we saw it at Bondi Junction. Got to take a break. We'll come back after the break and talk to a farmer who's living next door to a solar farm and has learnt the hard way that his property is very difficult to insure right now. And it's a story that other farmers around Australia need to understand. We'll get to John Conroy right after a break, right here at TNT.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was gonna make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like Latoya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
Latoya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Protecting. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. The Nonprofit Alliance.
You're with Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, let's get onto something completely different, but it relates to what we spoke to Stuart Ballantyne about. It's about energy and trying to find, you know, something that's practical and brings prices down and something that is able to be worked with in a reasonable fashion as opposed to some of the problems we're seeing with renewable energy at the moment. Well, there is a downside to whacking monstrous solar panel farms in the middle of productive rural districts of Australia. Your insurance will skyrocket, we have learnt. I bet you this wasn't addressed by anyone from the Climate Change Department when they spoke to farmers about what was about to pop up next door to them. Neighbours of large-scale solar plants say they will be rendered uninsurable or uninsurable because of their proximity to fire-prone infrastructure worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And how have governments reacted to this new reality? Well, they've run for cover and passed the buck. The Meadow Creek Agricultural Community Action Group, which represents farmers and residents whose properties neighbour a proposed 570-hectare, 330-megawatt solar plant in the King River catchment in northeast Victoria, has attempted to raise the issue with the government, but guess what? They've got nowhere. The group spokesman is John Conroy, whose family's multi-generational cattle farm neighbours the proposed development. He joins us now from northeast Victoria. John Conroy, welcome to TNT Radio.
Thanks very much, Chris. G'day.
G'day. Well, when this project was first raised, I bet no one told you of the impacts that might occur from living next door to a solar farm in terms of insurance.
No, we didn't either until we got a community group together and an action group and started discussing it. And then we've uncovered that we're going to have huge problems with living next door to a solar farm. With the insurance risk that we face, or you know, we're going to be next to a $750 million construction, and you know, we're intensive farms around here. It's highly productive, high rainfall country. We run a lot of machinery and a lot of electrical components and pumps, and you know, we have the risk of hay combustion. So you know, for as long as this solar farm exists, which could be 30, 60, 90 years next door to everyone in our community, we are at risk of burning it out. And once you burn it out, you are, you know, we are then liable for damages, which will be cleanup and the rebuild and loss of income.
So the greatest fear for these insurance companies is not what might happen on the solar farm to your property. It's the other way around.
Yeah, at this stage, from what we know, it is. That's our major concern at this point, because we've got, and it's pretty standard, we've got a $20 million insurance coverage for liability. And we can achieve up to $50 million. So the $20 million costs about $3,000 per annum.
That's today?
Yep. Yep, $20 million, $3,000 per annum. So that's what we've got currently. If we wanted to increase to $50 million coverage, that's you've got an exponential price increase because international insurers aren't liking Australia as a place to insure because there's so many natural disasters. So the $50 million insurance will cost somewhere around $30,000 per annum, which is unaffordable. And there's talk of up to $100 million that you get a bigger price increase again, but we certainly can't afford that. And if we're to burn them out, well, we're likely to do more than $100 million worth of damage anyway. So, you know, it can easily be a factor on a bad fire danger day in our area because it's, it's high growth and these solar farms will, they've got a lot of product on them that will burn. There's panels and electrical components, and there's a 250 megawatt lithium-ion battery that's going to be on this farm as well.
And the lithium batteries, as we know, are prone to explode if they're triggered.
That's right. And so, we as neighbours, we've got to deal with that. The owner or the operator of this solar facility will be a $2 shelf company, more than likely internationally owned. And if it burns, whether it's the 566 hectares of solar panels that light a fire or the lithium-ion battery that lights a fire first, well, once it burns, and it could burn out the district on the wrong day, and expose all the firefighters in the region to toxic gases and heavy metals and whatever else is going to be a part of it.
But the normal playing field when it comes to renewable power, with the normal playing field changed, they like to say to these solar panel and wind turbine companies, hey, listen, we're going to give you a subsidy to look after you, to encourage you to build what you're building because we need the power. And so we're going to change the game to a certain degree. Given the fact that the insurance game has turned on your head as a farmer next door to a solar panel farm, shouldn't those rules apply as well, where the government turns around and says, hang on a minute, we've got to come to your rescue on this?
Well, you would think so, but they don't want to know about it. We've made them aware of this 12 months ago and still have no answer. And the big problem with these solar facilities is that they change hands. So if the first owner does happen to sign on to some sort of agreement with the neighbours where you've got indemnity from liability, well, who's to know what happens with the second one or the third one?
Yeah,
because the ownership changes hands quite often.
So you've made an approach to the Federal Assistant Treasurer, Stephen Jones. Now, I would have thought, given the fact that these businesses are, being urged by the Climate Change Department federally to go ahead and they're being given certain amount of subsidies from the federal government, it's a federal government concern, isn't it?
Well, that's what we thought. That's why we contacted him. And then we contacted the state government.
But apparently the federal government office said you got to go to the state government. Is that right?
That was it. And when we contacted Jones at federal government. Then we contacted Pearson at state government. Danny Pearson. And he told us that we need to basically line our ducks up and make sure we get plenty of quotes to have a competitive insurance price.
Oh, stop. As if you haven't done that already.
But we can't even get insured. We can get insurance, but we're bankrupt. If we get the $50 million insurance for our coverage, if we burn them out and do more damage than $50 million, we get sold up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. It's we're a generational farm. you know, we're highly committed to the community, and you know, and we're very, you know, our whole community, we've got a great little community here. We're we're working hard. We're employing people directly and indirectly. We're producing a lot of food. We're producing a lot of income for the country as, you know, as an export income. Beef's a large export industry. Plus, there's many other industries around here. It's not just beef. There's hops and vineyards and, you know, fruit and a lot of dairies. It's it's a really productive region, and it's actually stated as on state mapping as strategic agricultural land, which is, you know, that's as high value as you can get in Victoria. Yeah. It's it's got an overlay on it, and in the government guidelines, they're not meant to be, a solar facility is not meant to be built on these, on strategic agricultural land, but because of this net zero agenda that they've got, they seem to be willing to break and bend any rules to make it happen.
Yeah, you don't question the evangelism. You don't question the evangelism, John, as you have now learned. But, you know, getting back onto this bit about changing the rules, change the normal playing rules because of this extraordinary event of establishing a solar farm, I would have thought too that if my next door neighbour puts up a louva on a window, I can have a big, you know, hoo-ha at the local council meeting about why this is blocking my view or doing something to my privacy or whatever. And yet when it's costing you millions of dollars in insurance, it's just waved straight through, like as if you've got to put up with it because it's next door to you. That doesn't sound fair nor consistent with the way properties around Australia have rights when someone does something different next door.
That's right. And we, once this, if the application is lodged and then in turn approved by the state government, by the planning minister, we actually have no right to appeal against it. But they've taken our right to appeal at VCAT away in Victoria.
So, and just explain that to me again. How have they done that?
They have just removed it. Premier Jacinda Allen stood up one day and in front of media and said that, you know, to fast track renewables, they have taken the third party appeal right away from anyone contesting a renewable energy facility.
Oh my goodness! But that's because by building these facilities, John, we're saving the temperature of the planet. We're preventing it. They've got those figures and they've presented them to you, haven't they?
Oh, they sure have. But I think we're the ultimate hypocrites, Chris. We're exporting a lot of gas and coal to the rest of the world. China and Japan and India, they're building all these coal-fired and gas-fired power stations, and you know, we're importing panels and turbines off them and selling them it's the people's, the Australian people's fossil fuels that, you know, for not very much money. It just seems ludicrous what we're doing, and you know, anyone with common sense that I talk to cannot work it out, but obviously the government know something that we don't.
So just going back on that second last point about taking that third party right from you, that to me says that you're up, you know what, creek without a paddle.
That's exactly right. Yes. It was pretty disappointing when we heard that, because we were, you know, we were always going to VCAT and then going to court if we didn't win.
I would have thought you got to go to the federal court and you get your justice, but the justice is not based on a fair set of laws because the law's been changed.
Yeah, the laws have been changed. Yep. And they're saying they're going to fast track these and have them approved within 4 months of the application getting lodged. So, you know, once the application is lodged, these $2 international shelf companies have spent 3 or 4 years studying this farm and prettying up this application to make sure it's going to be ticked off by the government. And then, you know, once we see the application, once it's lodged, we can then view it. And if we've got counter studies to put in, because with the environment issues or agricultural production issues or the aesthetics or runoff, because, you know, this farm is on a special water catchment area as well, which is Wangaratta's drinking supply. And it is an industrial zone. Like, you know, one thing that people probably don't comprehend is the scale of this farm. It is 566 hectares, and that is for those who aren't in agriculture and don't understand a hectare, that is a 10-meter wide strip of solar panels that runs for 566 kilometers. So this is just huge industrial scale, and they're going to keep coming because once this farm gets through, you know, we've got transmission lines running through here. They will, you know, they're considering upgrading them to give more capacity. And once they come through here, it will be the domino effect. People won't want to neighbour this solar farm. It's very lucrative to lease your farm out to these international companies to the developers to get them up to a solar facility. And you know, we've been approached ourselves 3 times, and it's we can just see the whole area getting destroyed.
Yeah. Yep, but it's to save the planet, John. You know, we're going to save the planet somehow. No one's got the figure that says we'll drop the temperature by any degree, because that can't be done scientifically. But it makes us feel good, John.
That seems to be what it is, Chris. It's hopefully people, you know, in the cities and, you know, people who haven't looked into this renewable agenda that the government have got, they need to do some study and form their own opinions and, you know, get a comprehension for what is going on. You know, the subsidies that you and I are paying, and, you know, every Australian in the form of large generation certificates or LGCs, the government is gifting these certificates to these renewable facilities or generators, and, you know, they are getting attached to the megawatts that they produce. The retailer then pays for that certificate along with their megawatt, and they on cost it onto our power bill. And, you know, and most people don't know that. And, you know, this has a factor for every dollar we spend. It's got a power component to it. And, you know, we're driving the cost of living up doing it. We've had a 45% increase in power bills in the last 2 years, and it's largely driven by this subsidy that's getting given to these international $2 shelf companies.
Too right. You've nailed it. Let's finish on that very negative point, but it's a very important negative point to make. This is why we can't afford our power bill at the moment, because of the kind of senseless, inefficient money we're throwing at renewable companies to create this renewable nirvana that does nothing. I just can't begin to... I'll just relax before I go off my nut. But John Conroy, I can only wish you all the best. I hope you can keep raising it. I hope you get more friendly media supporting you. And I hope that some in the opposition start to support you, so when and if they become in government, they might do something about it for you.
Well, our local opposition, you know, our local members who are in opposition, and our local mayor, they're very, very supportive. Dean Rees has been leading the charge, and Tim McCurdy, who's a member for Parliament in Victoria. We've got the backing of our local representatives, because they say it is just the wrong thing to do and it's going to destroy the area.
Good.
And
I'm glad they're on your side. Keep them on your side. Keep them honest. John Conroy, thank you very much for your time.
We appreciate that, the opportunity. Thanks very much, Chris.
Good on you, mate. No problem. I hope you can pass that information that you have gleaned from John Conroy on to family, friends. And I hope you can write to your local members about it and do something about it, because they are stuffed. All because of renewable evangelism and the fact that it's okay to support those who set up renewables, but those who are disadvantaged, who live next door, they can go and suck on it. That's what they're being told. Bad luck. You have to take the freight. You have to fork out the $30,000 just for insurance, like seriously. Very quickly, I want to tell you about an industry whistleblower. I'm always interested in whistleblowers who tell the truth. An industry whistleblower has blown the lid, according to news.com.au, on the shelf pricing tactic supermarket chains are using to the detriment of consumers and to also muscle out food suppliers. They don't just get stuck into consumers, they get stuck into their own suppliers. Abdel Badura told Monday's inquiry into supermarket behaviour that he witnessed firsthand Coles and Woolworths market manipulation after a decade of sitting in on price negotiations with suppliers. He said the big change exploited their duopoly to push around suppliers seeking a price increase on their products. Let me get to the next page for you, which has come. Hang on. Just bear with me for a second. Bear with me. I've got a frozen page and now I'm unfreezing it. Good. I've just unfrozen it. Coles and Woolworths are running risk-free businesses, he says. They are propped up by suppliers who are paying for the majority of their expenses. There are many suppliers who have to pay to get their stuff to the Woolworths warehouse in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane. With the Australian public being overcharged at every step, he says, every step. They have gotten away with this for years due to the lack of competition in the market and their market power abuse. As a result, you consistently see high recommended prices compared to other countries on the same products. Mr. Badura said in his experience, Coles and Woolworths would either reject or partially accept price increases and then determine a gap used to get suppliers to invest more money into their business. I will try and get hold of Mr. Badura and try and speak with him on this program. But until then, Sonia is up next. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. This is Chris Smith.